This podcast is sponsored by Canaccord Genuity Wealth Management, award-winning wealth managers who go above and beyond to support and guide you. Visit candowealth.com to start building your wealth with confidence.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Fraser Nelson. The government's interventions in response to plans for a Super League in football are stepping up a gear. The PM is meeting officials from football governing bodies, the FA and the Premier League, as well as fans' representatives later to discuss the proposed European Super League. Fraser, on the surface, this is a story about football, but it's also a story which has joined or at least united the country in widespread condemnation. We have Keir Starmer, we have Boris Johnson, we have Prince William. Does it look as though the Super League is going to happen? And is it about more than that?
I think this is a huge story that's not just about football. It's about culture, society, the limits of the free market, and how far big corporations can push their luck. I think that the all of the breakaway clubs would have wargamed this. They would have worked out that there would be uproar from the fans, uproar from the politicians. But the whole move is based on the supposition that there's nothing you can do. There's nothing you can do to stop us. Now, that's not the case in Germany, when Portugal, where there are rules that fans own almost half of the club. That's to stop them behaving like corporations who can do what they want. But in Britain, I mean, we've got this global appeal for our Premiership football clubs. They're some of the biggest businesses in the world, some of the most recognised British brands in the world, and they behave like global corporates. You can argue this is perhaps a logical progression of a path that they've been on now for 20 years. But you also have seen this very strange political reaction where Boris Johnson's got an article in The Sun pledging to stop it, basically, to show this Super League the red card, in his words. And I'm not quite sure how he's going to do that. I'm not quite sure. This isn't something that requires regulatory approval. It's not something that requires EU legislation. As far as I can work out, there's nothing stopping these clubs going off to come up with an extra match that excludes other things at all. So I'd be very interested to see, after having given these great political pledges to stop it going ahead, whether the politicians are going to carry through with their threats, if so, with what tools, or whether they might be about to demonstrate their impotence against corporate might.
I slightly disagree with what Fraser said, in that I think the government have quite a lot of tools at their disposal. First of all, you charge them in full for the policing of all their matches. Secondly, you turn around and say, you want to employ any foreign player. You know, we're no longer part of the EU. People require a work permit. You simply refuse to grant it. You know, and that obviously would reduce the quality of these teams and render the league much less attractive for fans to watch, because the idea that this would be bringing the best players from the world together wouldn't be true, because you would essentially be blocking them from signing any player from abroad by refusing them a work permit, because they're not British citizens and so not eligible to work in this country unless tier two visas for sport require a recognised governing body to sign off the application. There wouldn't be one in this case. So I actually think, a little bit like the COVID crisis, this has been a reminder that ultimately the state has a lot of power when it chooses to use it. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, there are lots of things that government can do to essentially, without having to nationalise the clubs or pass new legislation, to make life so difficult that this league doesn't work, and they would be forced with a much more dramatic choice of having to say, OK, we're going to take the names and relocate these clubs to some other place which is more open to the idea. You know, to use the American term, to kind of move a Liverpool or Manchester United franchise out of the UK.
Right, but just in the examples you've given, paying for policing, I suspect they would happily write that bill. It would be expensive, but they're probably going to stand. No, but when it comes to the visas, you're right. You could adopt effectively a policy of targeted harassment at a company that annoys the government. Now, if they were to do that, wouldn't that bring in a rather worrying tool that they could deploy against any other company that annoys the government?
Yes, but it wouldn't require any new legislation. And they could simply say that these tier two visas for sport require a recognised sporting authority to sign them off. And they don't recognise this new Super League, so there is no authority to sign them off.
So it's okay, so you're right there. There is a tool. The government could get into the business of targeted corporate harassment. That is something which, on principle, doesn't sound particularly attractive to me, but I can't see what other tools they would have.
I mean, that tool, considering the effect, if you essentially barred foreign players from signing for these teams.
Well, we actually got, we have a Leeds United supporter here, Katie. So
I was about to say, following my own team, we've had Patrick Bamford of Leeds United, which I've started supporting since lockdown, but I promise is sincere, say that without fans, every single club is nothing. So it's important that we stand our ground and keep it that way. One of the clubs that would obviously not be in the Super League. But Fraser, do you think then, if clearly you're uncomfortable with the perhaps the worst of capitalism that the Super League is, but also at the very anti-free market or the precedent of a response from the government, do you think the perhaps the middle ground or the best way out is ultimately peer pressure, where the lots of these players say they don't want to play in the Super League?
Look, I would love for there be some kind of fan boycott over this, or whether there is some moral or social pressure. But if you look at the people running these clubs, they seem to be pretty much immune to this pressure. Plus, they would have expected it when they went ahead with this in the first place. They're thinking, yeah, everybody's going to hate it, but then again, I'm going to get billions of pounds. And this is why I think this is such an appalling thing, because it really tests and abuses, in my view, the dynamics of a free society. To pursue profit to such an incredible extent, and these are organisations which, by the way, are pretty profitable even without this, but it basically invites the kind of draconian government response that James is talking about. And I've always thought that freedom is, you need to take the free enterprise system, freedom in general, it needs to be used responsibly so as not to lead into these controversies. It wouldn't be long until the governments never need much encouragement to go back into their industrial policy and picking winners. So next time, if it doesn't want it, it might not be able to stop a takeover, but it might say to Apple or something, if you don't pay your taxes, we're going to stop you recruiting who you want to recruit in London now that we've invented this tool for the football clubs. That's why I think this is, in general, a crisis that goes way beyond football.
I think we're seeing a broader picture at the moment of pushback against the power of multinational corporations by national governments. Look at the US's attempt to essentially create a global minimum corporation tax rate, to essentially say that companies would have to pay at least a certain amount of corporation tax everywhere that they were operating. You know, this Janet Yellen proposal. That is a big reversal in the shift of power between multinational companies and governments. But if they can pull this off, that's kind of existed since the 1990s. If they manage to succeed in doing this, take Apple, for example. Apple's plan of basing itself in Ireland, putting the profits through there, a country with a very low corporation tax rate, kind of wouldn't work under this Yellen proposal, which is a massive rebound. I mean, I think what we are seeing at the moment is we're into a new phase of globalization where the nation state is reclaiming power from multinational corporations. Now, we can discuss whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, but I think it would be very much in keeping with the spirit of the times if you saw national governments in the UK, in Spain, in Italy, acting to basically stop this Super League. I think the balance of power between corporations and governments is shifting, partly because governments are far more prepared to use these powers than they were even a decade ago.
I very much agree with that, James. I think we are, after a long liberal period, we're entering an illiberal period. You can see the rise of a liberal conservatism, I think, is one of the big themes of our times. We saw a lot of this. And I obviously, as an old-fashioned Adam Smith liberal, I do not welcome this. In a normal market environment, there'll be lots of competition, and I can't quite see what tools are there to punish. You need government to come up with a monopoly provision. That's always been the case. So governments have always, in free societies, have stopped people colluding by breaking it up. But can you really break up this as a kind of racket? I'm not quite sure you can. The thing is, I am not defending what the clubs are doing in any way. And again, perhaps as a liberal, this shocks me because this is such an invitation to government to say, you know what, our whole plan is based on the free market and liberalism and the idea that you can't stop us. We are daring you to stop us. We are daring you to come in and basically curtail the freedoms that up until now have been taken for granted in your country. And it wouldn't surprise me if something does go ahead like this. I suspect if deployed against the football teams, it would be deployed against other organizations. And right now, I think this is, to me, this is an open and closed case of a malign trend that ought to be stopped. I would love for it to be stopped by the fans and by pressure rather than by government, because government, if it acquires these powers, will not let them go.
Now, the other item in Boris Johnson's intro relates to Northern Ireland. The Prime Minister has pledged to end ludicrous barriers to internal trade between Great Britain and Northern Ireland, and said his government was trying to sandpaper the Northern Ireland Protocol into shape. James, didn't the Prime Minister sign up to the Northern Ireland Protocol?
Yes, I mean, this is always the problem for Boris Johnson when it comes to the issue of the Northern Ireland Protocol, which is that the EU are in a position where they can say simply, well, hang on a second, you signed up to this. Now, the worry for Boris Johnson is that the Northern Ireland Protocol is already deeply unpopular with the unionist community in Northern Ireland. All the unionist parties are trying to challenge it in court. And that is while all of these various grace periods, some of them the UK has granted to itself unilaterally, are still in place, meaning that we're not feeling the full effects of the protocol. So I think the question really is this, is can the UK manage to pull off a bit of diplomacy to basically say, look, to the EU, if you implement this protocol in full and rigorously, consent for it is going to collapse in Northern Ireland. The next Stormont election is going to turn into a referendum on the protocol, and that will be hugely destabilising to Northern Ireland. So it would be much more sensible to take a kind of risk-based approach to checks. For example, one of the big problems is if you are a gardener in Belfast and you want to order some plants from a nursery in Scotland, you can't essentially because of the risk that it might have traces of soil on it which would fall foul of the protocol. And so I think there is a case you could begin to say, look, in the same way that tariffs are only levied at goods on goods that are seen as being at risk of passing into the single market, could you apply the same logic to checks? That would be quite a big change to the protocol, and it's quite a diplomatic challenge for the UK to persuade the EU to accept that very different approach to the protocol.
Now, Fraser, the other piece of news dominating yesterday was Keir Starmer out on the campaign trail. The Labour leader hasn't had much of a chance to meet with voters. We've often heard from his team that he's very frustrated about that. Yet one voter he met with perhaps is an experience Keir Starmer would like to forget. Can you talk us through what happened when Starmer turned up at a pub in Bath?
Well, he was at a pub, which, by coincidence, I was at a few days ago. And Bath is so beautiful right now. If anybody listening here and doesn't know what to do next weekend, go to Bath. It's one of the most beautiful cities in this country. And it's, to be honest, it was a good reminder of what campaigning used to be like before lockdown. I mean, you do want politicians to be going out there, engaging with voters, getting into a bit of trouble. And what we saw here was a voice which has been politically unrepresented, which is a lifelong Labour voter, the pub landlord, who was hopping mad with Keir Starmer for not so much a failure to oppose lockdown, but failure to just oppose the government in general, to ask questions. I guess if you're looking at your business going up in a cloud of smoke for reasons that you think were avoidable, you're looking at the House of Commons and thinking, well, what party do I vote for? Who represents me? And because there has been a kind of wartime consensus on lockdown, that particular sort of voter has not been represented. So it was a colourful incident. Of course, it's obviously, you know, perhaps they should have worked out that the landlord of the Falcon Pub was this way inclined.
Did you meet him on your visit?
No, I didn't. So I just had a drink. But it's kind of a place which, you know, there'll be lots of people who will be feeling that right now. But by the way, you should say that there were other members of his pub who said, look, this landlord doesn't speak for me. He's got his own opinions. He doesn't speak for the rest of the staff. People were, I think, a bit taken aback to see it become a political thing. But I have to say that I did sort of quite admire Keir Starmer for getting stuck in. I do wonder if Boris Johnson's visits would be a bit so carefully stage managed, but that sort of uncomfortable confrontation with the voter wouldn't have happened. We used to see that far more often in campaigns than we do now. And it was, I think, a great example of democracy in action.
And it's interesting, Fraser, just picking up on something you said, that in a way, the landlord has been perhaps unrepresented when it comes to the debate, because Keir Starmer's response on social media after this was to say, here's my statement on what happened when I visited this pub, and you clicked on the link and it just went to the register to vote in the local elections. But which party do you think this landlord should vote for. I mean, it still feels as though there isn't much in the way of opposition.
Yeah, well, in fact, it was actually even worse than you say, Katie. The Labour Party put out a statement accusing him of spreading misinformation about the coronavirus, and we're not going to repeat it. Now, this is pretty strange. So it's saying, look, we are now going to censor the critical comments made by this chap because we believe it to be politically incorrect or epidemiologically incorrect. I've got no idea which. But right now, the only party to vote for is the Liberal Democrats. They're the only ones who are going into this local election saying that lockdown restrictions have gone too far and the government has overreached. So that is, now we'll see, you know, to be honest, that's not a message which Lib Dems are particularly saying very loudly. I mean, when you interviewed Ed Davey, Lib Dem leader, a couple of weeks ago for the magazine, he was talking a lot about that. But since then, you can't really go on the Lib Dem website and find a great cry of freedom being shouted by them. They're almost embarrassed by it themselves. So I'm afraid to say that landlord, unless you can find some smaller party candidate to vote for, he's not going to find somebody to champion his point of view, though it is a point of view shared by a lot more people than our current MP representation would suggest.
Now, finally, James, looking to Germany, the CDU have today announced their candidate for Chancellor, and we've also had the Green announcement yesterday. Can you talk us through the two candidates and what's behind it?
So, yeah, so the question in Germany was whether, you know, the CDU leader, Laschet, would be the candidate, the Chancellor candidate, or Markus Söder, who's the leader of the CSU in Bavaria. Now, Hull suggests that Söder would be a more formidable candidate for Chancellor. Laschet has a 60% plus disapproval rating in his own state, and yet they have decided to go with Laschet as a candidate. And I think that is a weakness. And I think the Greens have picked Baerbock, the 40-year-old woman. I think she will be a better presence on the campaign trail than Laschet. I also think there's an interesting point about coalition dynamics. Laschet's state, North Rhine-Westphalia, burns a lot of coal, and I think it makes a Green CDU coalition after the elections less likely, which suggests that even if the CDU were to come in as the largest party, we could well be looking at Germany having its first Green Chancellor, because I think in these circumstances, a Green SPD coalition could be more likely.
Thank you, James. Thank you, Fraser. And thank you for listening.